This Migration Policy Europe event, organized with the Bertelsmann Stiftung, was held in Brussels in November 2013 and focused on effective labor migration management, creating checks and balances while searching for talent. This panel focused on labor migration policy responsiveness to business and worker needs. The panel is moderated by Elizabeth Collette, Director of Migration Policy Institute Europe, and features panelists Konstantino Fotakis, former advisor to DG Employment with the European Commission, Karsten von der Linden, project leader at Boston Consulting Group, Pauline Mathewson with Fragaman Worldwide, and Marco Salento with the European Trade Union Confederation. Now speaking, Elizabeth Collette.
I'm very pleased to come back for a second panel, which comes at these issues from a slightly different direction. So we've seen what the data can tell you, what various academic analyses can tell you, and now I want to turn more to the people who are practitioners in many ways on some of these issues. And at a time of crisis and high unemployment, it seems often counterintuitive to ask, what are the business needs in the labour market, and how can rights of migrants be perhaps part of that dynamic on the labour market? I've often heard employers opine that it is the actions of a few unscrupulous few that ruin it for the rest of the employer market, and I'd be interested to see if that's true. It's a question that's particularly interesting for us because in April of this year, we organised a roundtable for Commissioner Malmström at her request to bring together a number of business leaders to discuss what is it that businesses really expect from labour migration policies, what do they need from labour migration policies, moving on from purely the how many, which is the question that preoccupies so many participants in this debate publicly and privately, but thinking about how do labour migration policies function in practice and how might that be improved. And I think rights and access to the labour market is core to those as well. Some of the key points that came from that roundtable include the fact that workforces are more dynamic, more mobile, but also less supported. There are fewer supported positions around the world. The predictability in labour migration policies is as important as their flexibility and their ability to incorporate new needs of the labour market. There was a strong feeling that businesses and the private sector and non-governmental actors view skills and talent differently from government and assess it differently, and that there is an increased need to work with education providers in order to produce the skills that might be needed in the future, the talent, which Crystal so spoke of so eloquently before. Europe is no longer a default destination, but it still has some notable attractiveness that could be enhanced perhaps if intra-EU mobility were to be increased. And then last month, Marco and I participated in a similar meeting with the Commissioner Malmström, bringing together trade union representatives. And some of the same themes came up again and again: the role of intra-EU mobility, the complexity of rights and the various categories in labour migration, and how that can actually hinder rather than support migrants in their ability to enforce their rights on the labour market and actually benefit from what they are eligible for. And also how to reconcile the skills needs with the reality of overqualified labour migrants on the market and the thorny issue of informal working. So one question is, can you reconcile the sort of rights and access with the practical implications of labour migration policies in practice? And so to first turn to Pauline Mathewson, who is a managing partner of Fragaman for the EMEA region, who also is developing Fragaman's government advisory services and thinking how to help governments think through these thorny issues. We'll speak to the sort of terms of the business needs in terms of immigration systems and how they work in practice. After that, I will turn to Marco Salento, who is an advisor on migrant workers and migration at the European Trade Union Confederation, who looks at the fair and equal treatment for migrant workers and how trade unions play a role in that. Thirdly, I will turn to Karsten, who is a project leader at the Boston Consulting Group, and has expertise in people and how they function in organizations and the search for talent as well, takes on a business perspective. And also, I looked at your CV, and there's quite a lot of psychology degrees in your background. So I wonder if you take a psychological profiling approach to talent acquisition. I'd be interested to hear more about that. And last but not least, turning to Kostas Fotakis, who is a former official with DG Employment, who is officially retired, but unofficially migrant nerds never retire. They just make longer PowerPoints. So we will turn to Kostas for his views on what the skills needs in Europe might be in the longer term. So with no more ado, if I could pass over to Pauline. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I thought I should tell you a little bit about what I do, because that will help you understand my perspective. So as Liz said, I'm the managing partner of Fragerman, and you may say, who's Fragerman, which is understandable. We're a law firm and a professional services firm. We do one thing, and that's immigration only. We employ over 3,000 people throughout the world. The firm's been around for 60 years, and I think it's indicative of the world market that it was for 50 years, was just a US inbound. It's the behemoth of US immigration. I'm sure Liz will attest to that. And then 10 years ago, so a defining moment when the largest company of the firm in the world said, we're going to go to tender for all our, so we provide work permits and immigration advice to companies moving people around the world. And that client said nicely, we're going to go to world tender and we expect you to provide services around the world, not just into the US. So I guess at that time, and I wasn't with the firm at that time, but there must have been a, oh my God, what are we going to do? Because this wasn't an opportunity, this was a defensive mechanism, because what do you do when that client who's in 50 countries in the world says, you must provide immigration work permit services and keep us compliant in every country in the world? And as a result of that, we're now in 16 countries in the world, and one of my roles is to expand that, and we'll move into about another 30 countries ourselves in the coming years. So with that, we represent the largest companies in the world. Some of our big clients move maybe 10,000 people a year on work permits. We manage those moves, and we keep them legal. And so you might say, well, So it is from that perspective of what we are right and not sometimes not quite as far up front as we'd like to be, because everything's urgent. So I thought I'd just give you a little perspective on what we see the largest companies of the world doing. So first of all, they're quite apolitical. They don't really care about what governments are thinking. They just want certainty. So I'm really talking in massive generalities here, but I can assure you they think that what they're doing is really important. Probably 10 years ago, they wanted somebody to help, to outsource a process. Now they want two things. One is they want compliance. That's all they're... So because it's reputation, reputational risk for these companies, you mightn't see it, but that's what they care about. If it moves, it moves the share price one pip, that matters. If they are found to be doing something they shouldn't be. And they want a business partner, and that means, to the point about Liz was saying about government strategies, it's no longer good enough for us to provide a service to provide work permits and keep their people legal. They want us to liaise with government for them and work out what governments are doing. And that's become even more more of an imperative, because with all the economic discussion, companies are not thinking about Europe. That's the one thing I can tell you in 10 years. It's just not on the radar. It's a fortunate, lovely part of the world to live, says I as an Australian. But it is a beautiful part of the world to live. But they are going elsewhere, and they have to go elsewhere. And a lot of companies are very much outside their comfort zone. So for me, the big focus is Africa. And there's a lot of, say, US companies that think everything should be done. I always say Einstein got it wrong, because a New York minute is definitely shorter than an African minute, and I've never worked out why, but that's the case when you're trying to get something done in Africa. Companies act for three different reasons, I think. They're defensive. They need to protect what they've got, but they're opportunistic and they're strategic as well. They're sort of strategic. So I think when I say opportunistic, the two countries that I think of, which sort of sends me a little crazy when they want to go there, one's South Sudan and one's Myanmar. Because when you're looking at a company, looking at markets and what they need to do, how are we going to differentiate? How are we going to get that next 1% growth in our top line? They're looking for new markets. So with that goes employment. And without doubt, everyone would prefer to be in a company, in a country where they could employ locally skilled people first, because there's a rule of thumb that it costs about three times the cost to bring in outside labour into a country to take them in than to employ a local. So I guess with that, the trends are, what they're doing is, so traditionally companies had what was called an expatriate program. So they were the people that lived a life of wonder and enjoyment in a country offshore that they could never have hoped for at home. So, and they had all the benefits, tax equalisation, housing, school benefits, etc. So companies are moving towards local, what they call local moves. That's a light touch, where people say they want to go, they've got skilled employment, and they'll move from country to country. But with that goes talent management, because the big stress for these companies, especially as they're moving into the emerging markets, is how do they encourage their people to go there? They often want to set up new markets, and they need a core skilled people to go to those countries. And then, and so what I'm seeing in the trends, and we analyse lots of trends for our clients because we have a lot of data, is that there is tends to, and they don't like it, by the way, there tends to be a core group of people that have just become permanent expats. They just won't go home. They don't want to go home, probably because they've got two families now. They've got a whole lots of things that they don't want people to know about. And that causes the company's problems, because they want them to go back and share their talents and other people to move. So that's a trend that a lot of companies don't quite know what to do with it at this stage. The other thing that's really, really clear is the short-term moves. So if you think about companies that are under pressure to move, you have the extractive industries. So the oil and gas industries have been around forever, and then all the subsequent upstream, downstream movements of people as a result of those industries. They've been around a long time, and they're under great pressure because they now, if they weren't compliant, want to be compliant. They need to be compliant. I certainly know of a US company that was fined by under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and they're up to $600 million in fines. And they have the monitor sitting in their office, and that means they can be delisted. So it's really serious. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the UK Bribery Act, are driving lots of companies to behaviour, and also just to be good corporate citizens. Reputational risk, can't underestimate that. And my view is that US companies are probably 10 to 15 years ahead of Europe. I did hear a company recently, a very, very large company, make a comment which I found quite unbelievable, when they said, it was a European company, I won't damage the reputation of the country, but they said, I guess compliance is the price of the fine, which is a really shocking thing when you're used to dealing with companies that want to be compliant. So Europe is catching up, and there's an awareness that they need to also be responsible for their employees, that you can't just send people offshore, they have to be responsible for their actions. So the big challenge for companies is the short-term moves. So the consulting industries are driving everything. So if they're moving into emerging markets, the first people that go there are the big consulting companies, whether it's to find, see if there's a place to put a telephone line or a satellite dish, or whether it's just consulting on the feasibility. But they have great stresses, because many countries in the world, particularly in the emerging markets, don't have a facility that contemplates something other than localisation. And I'll just say one thing to give you an issue about immigration policies. So I look at Kenya. Kenya is a really interesting country because it has done a great job economically of saying it's the gateway to East Africa. And in that it says, please come, start your business in Kenya. You can then from there go into Tanzania, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Uganda, Burundi, and if you're really brave, into South Sudan. So you can set that all up, you can be there. But when you look at its immigration legislation, it still has this, if you take it to the letter of the law, they're allowed three people that are expatriates or non-residents to work there. that's the CEO, the CFO, and someone else that I can't remember. So, but really, they have quotas. So they have nothing that contemplates a startup. They have no legislation that contemplates a company might want to be there without doing business there. And most African countries have a concept of localization, meaning that when you bring in your non-resident, they have to be replaced by a resident within, say, a period of time. And many, many countries have what's quotas, which are problematical as well. So 8-to-1 quotas, 10-to-1 quotas. The Emirates, which came up a lot today, the Middle East is very interesting. They have quotas, and there's usually something like 99 out of 100, and that means 99 non-residents. And let me tell you, for most countries, companies, that one that they have to employ locally is the biggest problem for them. Where are they going to find them? So it's really a big problem. So that's just an insight into what companies are doing. They're certainly moving to Africa, but it's still small relative to the rest of the world. There are obviously the BRIC countries, particularly China, is the big market for companies moving, and they're moving out, so they're out of Europe. And the European companies are quite uncomfortable about that because they've traditionally had a very big European pool of market to go to. But if people aren't spending, they've got to find other markets. So, for example, German companies are now looking to countries they've never been to before and are not comfortable about it. So it's a pretty new world to the point of what's happening in the world economies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think I'm hoping we'll come back to you when we can come back to a discussion about where that talent is being found and where companies are finding that talent around the world. I'm also particularly struck about the concept of permanent expats, which is not an unfamiliar concept for anyone here in Brussels. And with that, I'd like to turn over to Marco for a perspective, perhaps from the other end of the labour market.
Okay, so I work for the European Trade Union Confederation. It's the umbrella organization of all trade unions in Europe, in the European Union country and the accession countries. We made the migration one of the most important points on our agenda in the last few years, because as we have said today, there is an increasing flow of migrants in Europe, but also for the demographic reasons and the reasons that have been said, we are sure that in the future this topic will be always high on the European agenda as well. Of course, what is our main point? Main point is to ensure that migration cannot be a way to inject cheap labor forces in the European markets, in the European labor market. This would be wrong for many, many reasons and not sustainable, neither economically, neither for the social cohesion of the European Union. So our key point is to ensure that equal treatment can be applied to 30 internationals that are admitted to work in the European Union, and also for those that are already staying. So equal treatment means that if I have a job in a given company, my job must be paid and my working conditions should be the same of my colleague who is a citizen and is making my similar job. So same working condition for the same job on the same place. Then we have all this big complexity that we have seen today. It's difficult to achieve this objective. We have the problem of citizenship, access to social security, and all these aspects. Very complex. But what we see that today, especially when we plan we try to establish common rules at European level, we remain stuck on very self-evident things. You mentioned your background document, but also here the problem of attracting high-skilled migrants, intra-corporate transferees that are so long time awaited by the multinational companies to have a European directive. And the problem is there, what kind of treatment we should ensure to people that are transferred in a member state to work for a certain period of time. We consider the European directive a really good, important framework, common framework for attracting people. this is in the interest of the companies, but I think it's also an opportunity for Authentic Internationals to bring here high skills. But when we come to the problem of equal treatment, I give you this example because it's really the paradigm of certain ideology at European level. In the discussion on the negotiation between the Parliament and the Council on the very final text of the directive, the Council says, okay, we should ensure the ICT workers the same treatment we offer to the posted, to the EU posted workers. It means that, in practice, that if a Tunisian worker is transferred in German, the benchmark for the equal treatment is not the German worker, but the Bulgarian worker posted in Germany, which is absolutely meaningless. Equal treatment should be for the Tunisian workers transferred in Germany, the German workers, and not the posted one. So this is a big, and we don't know how this connection between the comparison of the intra-EU posting and the ICT workers arrived is completely meaningless. And what is surprising, that's also in DG Employment, they are supporting this. This, which is completely, there is no reason. And also when we think about the EU migration policy, we should understand that this intra-corporate transfer is belong to a specific aim of the European Union, to establish an area of freedom, security, etc. The posting of workers is a question for the internal market. If it's possible for, as someone mentioned, the Laval case or the fact of the Letton workers and Sweden and the Swedish workers, it was a case of EU mobility of workers. These people that leave the Letton countries, Latvia, to go to work in Sweden, anyway, they are moving in a homogeneous legal environment. It means that the legislation in Europe are or harmonized or coordinated, especially for many aspects of the many social aspects and in terms of employee protection. But when we come to intra-corporate transfers, we don't have this kind of harmonization or coordination of the legislation worldwide. So when we try to regulate the condition of entry and work of ICTs, we should keep in mind that we are working with 30 internationals, and the working contract remains with the country of origin, and they are transferred in Europe working in a member state, but with keeping the working contract with the origin countries. And we don't have with 30 internationals this kind of harmonization and coordination. But now the EU directive on intra-corporate transfers is stuck in the negotiation between the councils and the parliaments because of this, of these things. I mean, on this issue of equal treatment, which and also is, let's say, is made problematic, very technical. I'm talking something very technical, very legal, with a very legal approach, but because the discussion today is this at European level. And we are losing the main objective of the legislation or of the legislative initiative. The legislative was clear, is we want to bring, we want to have easier rules and faster channels for ICT workers, giving them equal treatment and giving them some rights and specific procedures to obtain the permits. And now we find ourselves in discussing these very technical issues that is completely meaningless. On the way around, we obtain a very good, or we are very satisfied with the directive on condition of entry and work of seasonal workers, of seasonal migrants. In that case, we have been able to create a legal framework in which the procedures are, they have a kind of single permit with few exceptions, so the procedures and the treat and the processing of the application is more transparent, is faster, and they have a good package of rights. It's not full equal treatment, I think, but this is a fair treatment of seasonal migrants. There are very relevant things. For instance, The Parliament recognized the role of the social partners when transposing the EU directive. This is very important because if you consider that seasonal employment is needed in certain countries need more seasonal workers, certain countries need less. Certain sectors are admittable for eligible for seasonal workers and certain others not. So the capacity of social partners to analyze the labor market, the needs of the companies, the condition of work are so important, and it can really help a transposition of the directive that creates a better enforcement of the EU directive. I think this is a good practice, can be used also for other directives. Second point is the fact that how many migrants we will need for the future. It's very difficult to say. The economic situation is very hard. Unemployment is very hard. The fact that we had the crisis is not changing the big challenge of demographic change. So we know that even if we have the crisis today, in the long term, we will need more workforce. But how many migrants, it will depend on how good we will be to bring women on the labor market at work, how much good we will be to keep elder workers at work, how good we will be in to manage our internal labor market. But nonetheless, even if we will be very, very good, we will improve productivity, etc., we still need a number of migrants. So, and we don't need only temporary migrants. It's because the demographic change, especially at regional level, it can be dramatic in certain European regions. So we know that certain countries and certain regions within certain countries, for instance Germany, they will need more stable migration. So what we say, we already say to the Commissioner Malmström, it's good to have a legislation on temporary migration, but we should add at these instruments for temporary migration, we should add some common instruments to have a more stable migration. And we should start to discussing this. And the very last point, and then I will stop here, is the problem of the irregular migrants. Irregular is true, it's undocumented migrants, so without the proper documents, or working irregularly. The problem here is that in Europe we have millions of migrants. So we can send, we can return or repatriate 200,000 migrants per year, all included, all 20, for the 27 European countries covered by the statistics, and we have millions of people. By the way, it's impossible to send them home, and it's not convenient to send them home because many of them are already working. They already made part of their integration path. So it's convenient sometimes, considering that we need more migrants, at least to start legalizing their position, making some amnesties, regularization. It is important to have a European framework because it's really a question of trust, of mutual trust among member states when they go for these kind of amnesties. So this is important to have a European legal framework. And most of all because we know that high skills are important, but companies, and this is what the employers say, they prefer to have skills acquired on the local labor markets. This is what our employers say. So the fact they have an architecture or a specialized worker that obtain a qualification in their own country is good, but they want these people to be recognized as qualified workers by the local labor markets. So once these people have spent some time in the local labor market, they're already known by the enterprises, by the employers, it's worth it to retain these people because it will be very difficult to try, very costly to train new newcomers. That is why, once again, temporary can be nice sometimes, but sometimes it's not really logic if we think of the objectives we have in terms of policy migration. And the integration in the labor market is done of opportunities, giving them the opportunities to be active on the labor market, to have access to the labor market facilities, including vocational training. It's also a question to protect them on the workplace in order to feel them part of the process. Feel part of the workplace where they live in. And many things to say, but at least I would stop here for the time.
That's a very comprehensive summary of the state of the EU's labour law affairs. Before we move on to the second half of this panel, I just wanted to ask you both a quick question. It seems that, in theory, the rules should be simple. If they were done at EU level, they should apply to 28 countries. We should have a much easier time of it, both from the perspective of compliance and also from the perspective of accessing those rights that are established through the EU. In practice, it seems to be a very different kettle of fish in terms of different legal statuses giving rise to different sets of rights. Over time, these might change, access to benefits, access to different parts of the labour market, changing over time. In both of your view, what would a good European policy look like from the perspective of compliance? What would you look for from a good European policy and perspective from real access to rights and equal practices from a migrant's point of view? If I can ask you first.
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is educate our clients, because many of the US companies can't even understand the fact that there is that they send, a US worker into Germany and they need a new work permit for Italy. So I guess we actually had a conference last week, our firm, and I did ask that question of some government speakers there, would we ever see an EU work permit? And they said no. that was probably the answer. It was just too hard. I gave up. So I think the thing that the corporate world wants, the big movers of people want, is some evenness and consistency. And it was interesting when we met Commissioner Malmström in April. She said the business community needs to be more politically active, more involved with the government communities. And my comment was, well, first of all, businesses are fairly apolitical. They just want to get on with the job. But the second thing is they don't even understand how to access that group. So I come from Australia. I know exactly how to access the Minister for Immigration. I know how to access the Minister for Commerce and Industry and the labour unions, and I know exactly what it is. So I asked our office in Germany, so if we wanted to go to the German government and suggest they don't have a high net worth category of immigration, they don't encourage, there's no sort of entrepreneurial category, and the answer I got was exhausting. I lost the will to live trying to understand what I needed to do to go and find these various government, because it depends on which group it is, whether it's a visa, whether one of them might be the tax authorities, the economic departments. So I think it's not quite answering the question, but if you wanted to make it easier and get some interface with what was going on, it'd be really good. And she nodded her head in agreement when I said it's not easily understandable for a business outside that's agile and in a hurry to understand these 26, 28 states that are really doing different things. And then you have this peculiarity called the UK, and another one is Denmark. There's the other one, there's the outliers, who just keep being a little bit different. So I think the Schengen visa is very important, but some sort of evenness and some sort of accessibility, and if anybody knows, that would be quite interesting. That's not political, you know.
Thank you. I think the people who know aren't going to tell you, except for a very large fee, unfortunately. Marco, do you have any thoughts on this?
We are asking since a long time, so I'm also tired to say that we were asking for a framework directive in which could be clarified at European level. And they are legitimate. I mean, at European level, there should be the possibility to have a common legislation because of the Schengen area, but also because of the single market, etc. We are asking for a framework directive in which we say clearly what are the procedures to obtain a visa, simplification of the procedures and the single procedures, and an homogeneous level of protection for all migrants. Then we can add some, for specificities, we can add something, but it's important to have a single legal framework. This is not possible because member states don't want it, so it's impossible for the time being. But at least when we prepare the legislation, we should try to make the different directive as close as possible. if I was talking to you about this ICT directive, because it's perverse to make things more complicated than they can be, mixing things that are not related one with each other, like the posting and the ICTs. And what is unbelievable, that it's especially in digital employment, that you should be aware of the problems that workers have in terms of coordination of social security, in intra-EU mobility, and they could make something to clarify these points. So the contribution they could give is exactly this, to simplify the EU legislation to allow intra-EU mobility and coordination of social security, just to give you two examples, because there's something that maybe DG Home Affairs cannot do because they don't really have experience on this. But on the contrary, we see that they try to complicate the things with sometimes ideological points of view in using as a benchmark for equal treatment in Germany, the Bulgarian workers posted in Germany. So this is exactly the things that we should try to avoid to do. But by the way, as you see, we try to contribute in pushing and having this clarification and more homogeneous framework.
Thank you very much. And if I could now turn to you, Carsten, for your PowerPoint.
Could we
do a little panel shuffle?
Sorry about that. It's actually already open.
Okay. Hello also from my side. Thank you very much for the invitation to the MPI, to the Bertelsmann Stiftung here. I will not go onto your note with the psychology. I feel as a colorful dog enough as it is, being here in this round of policy, lawmaking, etc. Maybe also the first question, who of you knows BCG, at least a bit? Okay, not everybody's asleep, so I would say fairly half. Let me just give one or two sentences on BCG. So we're the world's largest strategy consulting firm. There's a big consulting firms in the world. McKinsey, BCG, and Bain are namely the three, and BCG as those three as the largest strategy consulting firm. We're actually in a lot of emerging markets. Referring to what Pauline said, I think we're in 35 countries in total, have 70 offices, and we work with businesses. Basically on all questions which bring them competitive advantage. So where to go, what to do, and basically we also have recognized a couple of years ago, the many challenges that businesses are facing, especially with the demographic situation. So what I've brought here for you just as a presentation is our insight on problems and solutions for this question. We do also do a bit of economic research. There was one exhibit in Crystal's presentation. We try to analyze where the skill gaps are, where the demand job market's going, but then we also work with businesses to tell them what they can do. So basically, this is one of the slides that we start with a lot of companies. We developed it in the crisis because companies, basically in the fourth quarter, they had significant revenue drops. When the Lehman crisis was, all of their revenues dropped and everybody was, terribly afraid what to do now. Basically, companies at the time debated two levels. The question was return to historic level or return to historic growth. If we look at this revenue now, it's basically also the demand of employees dropped. The companies, they were selling much less at the time, and then, they didn't need these employees. And the question is, okay, will they pick up to a historic level or historic growth? If we put that on a scale, though, what we see in terms of the demographic development, starting with the 1800s, and that's where we have data, if you look at, this is the working age population, and this is only Europe, we are at a significant turning point, which you all know, but this is a nice animation, where essentially we now have, in the next couple of years, it's really coming to the case that there will be less people active in the working age population in Europe significantly. And even if, and we love doing scenarios, even if this is the dotted line, if you extend the working age to 70, it's still not going to get any better. Yeah. So, when we consult companies, we tell them this is a huge thing coming up. And, in Germany, it's going to start 2015, 2016 really to decline. They're starting to realize it more and more. We can have these strong presentations, but this is going to be a significant challenge for everybody. Now, what we've worked actually with the World Economic Forum in 2008 or 2009, 2010, I believe, also created some reports on global talent mobility also global talent risk. So those are inside for readings. I don't have any slides here with me today because, I mean, it's already 2-3 years old. What we have now, and this is pretty new research, we're trying to do a global workforce planning approach, basically where we look at the supply, okay, how many people will be in the labor force until 2030. This is coming a bit in a second also to what Marco was referring on. And we also want to look at the demand. I won't show you this entire formula on the demand. It's basically we are using different GDP estimates or different GDP histories and then basically projecting it into the future. It's pretty simple math, actually. But from that, and I'll show you some results that we have here for a couple of countries. We get basically see, okay, where there are gaps and there are surpluses, and then there are measures that we hope could be worked on. So looking at this chart, and I actually won't go too much into detail, just the supply side. Crystal already mentioned it. 2012 to 2020, first countries will already see a decline. Germany is in there, Poland is in here as well, Japan, Russia. These are brand new UN data, but if you look to 2030, it's going to be much stronger also in the other countries, but especially in Europe. So this is so much for the supply side. If we look now at this gap analysis, and this is basically Germany and the US on the right side, you see that the supply number of people in the active workforce is going down from, I would say, around 42, 43 million basically today towards 36 million in 2030. And this is actually, and we have three scenarios, this is the demand. And 5-year, 10-year, 20-year is basically the extrapolation of the last GDP. If you take the average GDP in the last 20 years, this is what the growth will be, the bottom line. The last 10 years is the dotted line, and the upper one, the last 5 years, which have been pretty much of a boom in Germany, I would say, this is where the demand would go. And you see that 2015 is pretty much the date when they all will intersect, and after that it's just going to get worse. Yeah. I'll show you some more countries. What our research has shown for the US, labor supply is growing still. And basically, 20-year demand, 10-year demand, and, well, if you have the five-year base demand, would actually go down. But the U.S. do have an unemployment challenge still. And, I mean, I'm not sure if they would pick up to the average GDP that they had over the last 20 years, but it's not gonna change. Looking at India, basically here we looked at the number of people as a supply because India has a large also employability issue. If you look at demand 20 years, 10 years, and 5 years, it's pretty much actually growing, so it's not clear where that's going to go. China, actually, with the one-child policy, has a similar challenge that we in Germany face now, but way out into the future. And I mean, now, there were talks, or I think news last week, that they will change the one-child policy. They're working on that because, I mean, I think they still have time enough to basically switch their population politics. But I mean, the way it is now, they would also incur this with the current GoFits. Yeah. All right. What could be done? So essentially, I mean, what does shortfall mean? If you have more demand than supply, these countries will not achieve their growth rates. So, they will not be economically successful. Or, they have to, and this is coming back to what Marco said, they have to increase their labor productivity, so the people have to work more, essentially, or their workforce supply. So workforce participation rate, women, elderly people, what are retirement ages, etc., increasing immigration and mobility, here we are, or also incentivizing higher birth rates. So, I mean, for these countries, coming from a strategy perspective to be successful, there's a lot to do, actually. What does surplus mean? If you have too many people, these countries will have or stay with unemployment, or basically they have to do something to boost their demand. Workforce utilization, for instance, going into that the people are better trained, because I mean it's always a dependency. If you have better trained people, they will be more economically active and the economy will also grow. But really have to work, especially on this education point. And I think, in the U.S. it's surely a challenge, but reducing the shadow employment, moving people into the official workforce is also a challenge. I wanted to show you one calculation because I was actually smiling when Marco said, wow, it's very difficult to calculate. I mean, we you know, our business is calculating, so we try, juggling with some numbers. So we did this for Germany, and I think we have some other countries as well. Labor gap in Germany, I mean, expected GDP growth is 1.3% over these years. Productivity growth, so they will get more productive, 0.87%. Labor shortfall of 8.39 million. Structural employment, 5%. So that means Germany in 2013 with a labor shortfall, as we, you know, extrapolate it now, with 10 million. Essentially 28%. So drivers to close the gap, if we say participation rate of workers over 65 years, currently it's at 4.1, it would have to go to 10%, just as one driver. And I mean, you can basically combine these whatever way you want, right? Participation rate for working age women from 71% to 80%. Net immigration also increased, 369 to 460. And then basically also the labor productivity growth rate would have to increase. So if you did all these drivers and they were actually successful, you would close the gap. Now, obviously, there are unlimited possibilities what you can do. You could say we boost immigration to 1 million. Women, that's fine. We'll leave it as it is. So basically, I mean, this is where the politics then have to come in to basically figure out, okay, what could be done and what is helpful. But this is just some numbers on the challenge. So essentially, I just want to switch out to this perspective because I think hopefully it's going to be relevant for you. When we take this to corporations, to companies, and they're shocked, and they look at us and say, okay, what can we do? Essentially, I mean, one of the things that I'll go into detail is we recommend companies to try to do a strategic workforce planning, go into just a bit more detail in a minute. But we also see that companies are moving much more towards being very active in terms of recruiting, employer brand, fighting to have a very good reputation on the market, basically also globally, because they need to find their employees also elsewhere. Lifelong learning, especially as a challenge, because they will have to employ people much, much longer than in the past. And essentially, talent management in the sense that, you know, they give people a possibility to grow and to develop over their careers. So these are four action areas. If I just go to the strategic workforce planning example, and I'll be done in a minute. I know I'm way over my time. Sorry.
You have pretty pictures that gives you an extra.
It's good, huh? Yeah, it's like cinema. I know. So essentially, I mean, we've done this at a lot of companies that we think it's really very, very good. Syngenta is a Swiss company. They are growing very strongly, and they do fertilizers, but also high-performance chemistry for agriculture and everything. So essentially what we're working on with them, or we worked on with them, is said, okay, if they want to strategically plan their workforce, the first step they have to do is they have to look at everybody that they employ and say what kind of skills do they have. So like a classical job clustering. If you have engineers, you have chemists, but you also have production workers, you just have to get them into a landscape. Then basically you're looking for the company at what we looked on at the global level. You're looking, okay, how will my workforce develop along these groups, and how will the demand develop? And this is basically where the strategy comes in, because, I mean, if, for instance, Syngenta is saying, okay, we want to grow very strongly in China, this is coming from the business strategy, or we want to open a new site here or go into a new product, this is basically all drivers that they have for their resources. I mean, this is where then the link is to Fragomen, where they say, we need to get 100 engineers from, I don't know, from Germany over to China to build this factory. So this is what we do with them, and then basically out comes a nice picture. You know, Syngenta is saying, okay, you know, we'd like to build this factory in China. It comes out, okay, you need like 100 new engineers, and basically there's a huge gap that they basically need to fill. It's a piece of powerful analysis that is actually step number five. We sometimes then use it also to challenge this growth strategy, because oftentimes companies will say we want to do this, and they don't think about the workforce challenges. And if you come back to them and show them the numbers, step five, they will actually also challenge, is it really feasible to do such a project? Shall we not maybe go to a different country where it's easier to get the resource, etc.? And then basically, I mean, coming from this, you can then very simply define what you have to do, where you have to hire, where you have to transfer, all of these actions. Yeah? I just want to show you in terms of this carpet that I mentioned. This is just an example, and this is actually from Daimler, the automotive manufacturer that we also worked on. You know, a lot of qualifications, and you see if you look at basically the overall numbers down here, you will say, okay, you know, there's a surplus. But if you then look at which skill groups have a surplus or a gap, you can see, okay, you know, production IT experts, we don't have enough. But technical workers, we have too many. And if you then extrapolate it out into the next couple of years, you can also see, well, okay, you know, it's going to get even worse. And this is actually, it looks extremely colorful, and you are probably also all going to say, well, he colored the slides, and it's just his imagination. But this is actually a real example. We anonymize the numbers, but it looks like this. And if they see that, they say, oh my gosh. And then, I mean, for instance, here on this robot expert, you could say, well, you know, in 2015, that's fine. I'll just hire him from the job market. And this is really where the big challenge is coming in for companies, and I'll show you this. Because if you need this robot expert in 2015, if you need 32 people, a lot of these companies, and especially the ones in Europe with the very high, highly professionalized skills, they need qualification times that are humongous. If you look at this robot expert, and this is somebody that's working at Daimler, basically steering one of these robots that does like the final assembly and the final paint coating for trucks in this example. If you need 32, they first have to be a painting specialist for 3 years. So you have to basically calculate backwards. Then they have to be a painter, and then they have to be a mechanic. So that means if you're hiring somebody now, you first have to give them an apprenticeship as a mechanic, 3 years, then as a painter, another 3 years, then a painting specialist, and then basically you have this robot expert. Then you have people, you know, they quit their job, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a huge challenge for companies, especially with the highly skilled workforce that they need. They can't hire it off the market. And, you know, if they need it in a couple of years, they have to basically start now. So what we see, this is going to be a significant disadvantage to many companies where their business models will be challenged when they basically get to the stage and they cannot react. And if you think about, you know, this is training somebody that's coming from the German school system. If you're hiring somebody from India, it's going to take another years, you know, to learn the language, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a huge, in German, it would say Rattenschwanz, it's like a rat's tail, but it's a huge challenge that, you know, it's still a couple of years down the road, but companies that aren't starting today have a significant disadvantage. Basically, I mean, when we then work with companies, we say, okay, looking at these gaps, there are several things you can do. You know, you can hire people, but you can also train, transfer, out or insource, or sometimes in areas, reduce capacities. Yeah. Last example, and then I think I'm done. Yes, 1 minute. Very good. For instance, the German telecom, Deutsche Telekom, is a very large telecommunications company. And if you look at the shifts that the network's infrastructures have made over the last years, in the past you always had like tons of thousands of copper wires, but everything has gone to glass fiber. So that means they found themselves in a situation where they had 10,000 of copper wire mechanics that were no longer necessary because they needed fiberglass mechanics. And, you know, if a company, it takes 2 to 3 years to cross-qualify somebody, you know, we think that doing this and seeing where your gaps are early on is much better because you can then say, okay, we have these people, we will retrain them with 45 instead of laying them off. So that's the big hope that we have. I'm done. With the last minute. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I can just ask one very quick question, which is how far, when you're working with these countries, does local workforce development play into it as opposed to sourcing skills from overseas? Are they willing to invest in the areas around which they live, perhaps to reduce some of these immigrant employment gaps that we've been talking about in the previous session, to try and identify the potential for those skills early on? Right. Even as school leavers and bring them into the workforce.
Definitely. And I mean, I'll hold it with Pauline here. Companies are extremely pragmatic and very unpolitical. They are, you know, they're very interested in a solution and a solution which is, you know, as most best predictable for them as possible. So that means in terms of hiring, it's the point. It's a pretty clear graph. The higher up you go in qualification, the more international companies will source. For instance, I mean, we worked on a lot of recruiting strategies for one example is a chemical company. And if they're looking to hire people coming in with 16, 17, 18 years of age into their chemical training program, from like a a high school or mid-level school, they will look, you know, within 30 or 40 kilometers. Yeah? So basically, because they're saying, well, if if our company is basically in the Ruhrgebiet in Germany, we're not going to look through Frankfurt because people will not relocate in the profile that we're looking for at age 16 or 17. So they really are very local. Obviously, then if you go much further, and then you have basically engineers. I think what I see that there's a large preference by companies to source in their home country because they know what they get in terms of skill profiles. They know the universities. So what I see, be it in Switzerland, maybe less, but especially Germany, but also France, extremely strong, but also the UK, they're very much focused on sourcing nationally. And if you then go to the higher level management, specialized skills, it gets more international. And I mean, companies are still making that step, going from Europe then globally. But when these profiles get more rare, obviously they source then around the globe. So it's pretty linear graph.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And if I can turn last but not least to Kostas. I don't know if you want to swap to do your PowerPoint presentation.
Nice. So I think that Karsten and Crystal have, to a large extent, presented in a very effective and fast way. I admire you because I cannot speak so fast as you. The main challenges. I think the only difference would be that you presented the challenges predominantly from the angle of a German business, while I would like to introduce to the debate also a broader angle, which is an angle of Europe, which is more and more contrasting, where you have a core which is going quite well, and then you have a periphery with enormous unemployment. So the major preoccupation today in Europe is unemployment and insecurity. It is not a coincidence that the anti-immigration campaign is targeting precisely on these two elements. So I think that these are part of the debates that should not be neglected when we want to develop a strategy, and the European dimension is worth examining. So what we see first, as a first issue, is this situation of lasting and persisting unemployment in most EU member states, and at the same time, important skill shortages, increasing skill shortages in the most dynamic industries, which indicate an important structural issue. Here we have a curve which is very often called beverage curve, which shows in the vertical axis the shortages, labor shortages indicator, and in the horizontal axis, unemployment rate. So we see that after 2010, we had an increase both of skill shortages and unemployment, which is persisting. A second point that we have to see in this context is that at regional level, we have very contrasting situations in terms of employment rate and unemployment rate. If we can move to the second slide. So you see that there is a core with employment rates more than 75% and unemployment rates less than 6%. While you have the periphery with employment rates less than 65% and unemployment rates much more important, more than 10%. So it is true that over the last 3 years we had some notable increase in mobility, but even if we multiply by a factor of 3 the present levels of mobility, we will still end up with a similar cart. So mobility in Europe is not enough, even if it is increased substantially. to address. Besides, there are other studies that show that people move for health reasons, move for education reasons, move because they married, move because they don't like their house. But when it comes to labor, there are a lot of issues. First of all, if they are married, there is a problem with the wife. Third, when they move, they lose their social network, which they don't like. They have to work in a foreign language. And all these are costs that should be taken into account. So this is another issue. So against this background, we have also demography. I will not go very far. I will just say that we are going to lose something like 15% of our workforce until 2060, which is very important. It will be from the next decade onwards, we will have losses of 300,000 workers every year. So if you want to have 1% growth of GDP, and the working population in Europe is 350 million, you need just more than 3 million, more than 4 million at a 75% employment rate just to have 1%, plus you need the 400,000 for those that will be the reduction of the workforce, plus you need a very important number, because some migrants that you had in 2005, they will take their pension. So you have to cover also this. So I think that after a certain period, the size of the migration needed to compensate, if it is to rely alone on migration, will be such a big number that it becomes unmanageable. And what it comes as a conclusion is that the only sustainable source of growth, sustainable, because of course we can increase the working age from 65 to 67, but this is a temporary effect. The only sustainable source of growth will be the increase of productivity. And this particular element call for more emphasis on high-skilled people, on people that will not only increase employment, but will also increase productivity, because that will be, in the years ahead, very important. And as it was said before, the low-skill work is supply-driven. Even if you do nothing and just regularize every 5 years the people that they are entering legally, you will have a very important flow. But the needs of the supply of high-skilled people is in shortage and in high competition, and it will be more and more. Even countries, because there are two reasons. It's not only the demographic. It's the reason that technology moves very fast. Education systems cannot follow. And therefore, the people will grab there will be a competition for the very skilled, because we don't know exactly. We cannot plan 10 years ahead what will be the demand in 10 years. So I think strategically, both at micro level and at European level and at the macro level, this is something that we have to not to have illusions about that. So I will just... So we have two trade-offs. The one is this question of distinction between short and medium term, because in the short term we can still see a number of sources for alleviate the problem workforce. We have to improve mobility, we have to increase the employment rate and all this, and migration can also help. But in the long run, I think we have to focus really strategically on productivity, and because to prepare that we need to start at least 10 years before, I think it's a matter of concern already now for policymakers. The second question is low skill versus high skill. I think there I made my point. The one demand, and I think the point you have made is, in my mind, something like integrating in a broader supply and demand mechanism, not only the price, the wage, but also other elements, and make shadow pricing, including also the rights. I mean, that is how I understand your approach. So what to do now? I think one thing is investing on lasting partnerships with the countries of origin. I think this will be very important. We cannot continue a policy of stop and go. And when I say investing in lasting partnerships, I mean invest also in the education system of the countries. Because if someone has to go to Germany, he has to have education that is compatible to the German working conditions. And there are questions of language, the questions of terminology, questions of customs and civilization and all this. And I think that you cannot have... These are obstacles to go to a country. Then, of course, another very interesting area where Australia has done a lot of progress is attracting students. Attracting students is a very good way to integrate people, high-skilled people, in the labor market. Then, of course, improve the transparency and effectiveness of recruitment mechanisms. There are lengthy procedures very often which discourage people. And last but not least, I think, is the question of the attractiveness of living conditions. I mean, we cannot attract migrants if our people, population, is xenophobic. And if there are incidents every day in the country, that will be not possible. There are other countries, English-speaking countries, where the majority of the population were migrants, and people feel more comfortable in these countries. So I think the living conditions is something that often is neglected, and the countries of destination have to offer better living conditions to attract talents. Now I will close by saying a few words about the role of the European Union. I think that the negotiation for the blue card have showed that the member states want to keep some independence in the area of migration. There was a critical question whether we'll have a single blue card system in Europe or we'll have 27 plus one. And the member states unanimously called in favor of 27 plus one system, which shows that they consider that this is an issue of determining the quantities of people is an issue of national interest, and therefore they have to maintain their independence on that. But nevertheless, the European Union can play a very important role, first of all, in monitoring policies, because we have enormous gaps of data to monitor. We have harmonization problems. We have surveys about migration, which the last one was in 2008, and I don't know if there is a new one at European level. So we cannot follow, monitor the situation without having data. This is somewhere where only Eurostat can help. Then, of course, I think that we should more invest on a common framework of rights. This is very important, and this can be done only on European level. We could also take on board better the question of brain drain. Then, finally, I think there are a number of other issues, like promoting the cooperation in the area of accreditation and also facilitating the mobility of migrants, which is also another issue, that the European Union can provide some contribution. I think I will stop here, and perhaps I could extend my points in the debate.
Costa, thank you very much. I think you've encapsulated some of the key. Perhaps that's the post-dotcom agenda, and we can all go home in some of these aspects. I'd like to open the floor for questions, and I see two immediately at the front, and three. So Thomas, Martin, and gentleman there.
Thank you. Thank you for a set of very, very interesting presentations. Actually, I would have questions for everybody, but I will restrict myself to one, and perhaps it's more directly addressed to Carsten and Pauline, but if the others would like to add on, that would be more than welcome. It's this whole question of how do companies react to those shortages that are coming up. For the big companies, that's perhaps less of an issue because they have they're globalized and they are also more attractive and they get locally the people they need, and if they're more specialized, then they will find a way. But for all these small and medium-sized companies, which make up the bulk of employment in many countries, and in particular, of course, in Germany, how do they go about with that change? Do they rather restrict themselves? I mean, do they restrict expansion? Because they need one person, but it's not extremely critical. I mean, they could take up a few more demands, but they will say, "Well, we are fine with that. We have sufficiently work to do." So they just restrict their business, which just send implications on productivity growth and all the other issues that we are talking about. Or are they starting to look as well abroad? I mean, my impression is that these small and medium-sized companies, they're really stuck somewhere and they rather restrict their growth rather than expanding. And this, of course, has very, very important implications for all the rest that we have been talking about.
All right. So I'll start. It's a fantastic question because they do build up the economic backbone. So essentially, if you're looking for qualified staff, you have several levers. The first lever is basically compensation. In any company, if you're not finding the people you want, the first lever is probably you increase the compensation. If you're at a pain point where you can't or you don't want to go any higher, the second lever that they will go into, and this is actually the one that's a catastrophe, is quality. Because if you're looking for somebody to hire for 50K euro and you're not getting the person and you're going to 60 and you're going to 65 and you have the feeling, okay, well, I'm significantly above market, probably then they will decrease their quality and say, okay, well, maybe not somebody with so long experience or somebody with a worse university degree. And this is basically, we always say good people are basically the backbone. If you have good people in your workforce, your company will be better. And if these companies start hiring not as skilled workforce, probably in the definition here, it's still going to be high skilled, but there are a lot of different bandwidths. They will also, not be as competitive as other companies. There are few companies that really make what we would say a strategic move, thinking out of the box or in a new box, going to a different country or, having a school cooperation or just thinking about the problem creatively. There are very few. Because if you look at the reality of all these small and mid-sized companies, they're oftentimes, not in a large city, somewhere in the rural countryside, basically have a very, very limited view of the world and are basically then also challenged to think beyond the horizon. So as of now, I would say the majority are not having any, significant strategic ideas where to get new talent besides this compensation and quality. But maybe Pauline.
Yes, thank you. I can only say what I see companies doing. And the German SME market is quite unique in that it's so rich and so large. I don't know of another country in the world that has this old, moneyed, wealthy family generations of businesses. And I think that, our practice in Germany has dealt mainly with, say, the DAX companies who tend to be now moving out rather than trying to source in. And I'll give you one example. About 5 years ago, I've seen two major moves of companies, of people into Germany, and one of them was several thousand people. They were from Romania and Malaysia, and that was 5 years ago, and that company isn't working in Germany anymore. They're working in Romania. So what they did was go through a massive training program of bringing in Romanians and Malaysians over. It was a two-year program. They moved them around the world. They moved their key people to the US to train, and then they now have major operations in those two countries and not in Germany. So that's a classic example of an extreme example in a high-tech field that they had to do. They felt they had to do that. But on the SME market, they've been very slow, but what we're seeing is that I sense that they didn't know where to find people. Their reaction is probably they've gone through the sources of uplifting salaries, but they're looking to overseas markets, but they're quite nervous about where to do it. So it seems that the German companies have very strong chambers of commerce and regional communities, and then now we're now seeing a big build-up of inquiry through them as to, and obviously we don't source people, but they're looking at other markets now, and that's the first time I've seen that. That's probably in the last 12 months.
Yeah, thank you. I agree. Four really interesting presentations. Got two questions. I mean, both Karsten and Paulin made an interesting point that kind of your clients are apolitical, and I think, and that's very much my experience when I talk to employers. Generally, they just say we want the best workers and we want to make this work. Now, of course, that's a problem for countries because nation states are inherently political. So, on the one hand, companies want the best workers, but most countries are under pressure to make sure that domestic workers are given a first shot at employment in the country. Now, maybe some of the global players are excluded from that. But there's an immediate tension between the companies saying, we want the best workers. Because if all countries gave the companies the best workers, my hypothesis would be that in most countries, the domestic workers would not get the job, because why would the best worker be in the country? So my question for Paul, in a way, how do you and your clients engage with countries that require you to do things like labor market tests, to do things like, you know, to say that, well, before you get access to your migrants, you have to show us that you cannot find domestic workers, localization policies, I think you mentioned them. How do your clients think about those, and how do you, in a way, think about those? And for Karsten, well, that's a bigger question, and maybe there's no time to understand that, to debate that now, but I always get slightly confused in immigration debates when we put so much emphasis on immigration and GDP, because, I mean, you're projecting demand based on total GDP. I mean, why? So if we have a growing economy, if we have more migrants, then we have more GDP, we produce more. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing. It doesn't mean that well-being or the people who were there before are better off. So, you know, why don't we think about GDP per head or GDP of the existing population? Why is all this debate about GDP is going to go up? If you have a declining population, GDP is going to go down. Well, yes, it will. But it doesn't mean that GDP per head is going to go down. Do you understand why? You know, I think there's a confusion sometimes there. There's this focus on GDP as a whole.
Could I just suggest we take the second question back there first and gather the questions, and then I have a tiny one to add as well.
Yes, my name is Jörg Peschner. I'm coming from DG Employment, the same unit or the same directorate as Kostas before he retired. We did together this paper, and what strikes me is the presentation, of course, all of them, but specifically of Karsten, because what he did was actually quite similar to our work, and his results were very nice, as he showed where you can juggle around with higher productivity, higher migration, and all these ingredients you can have in order to improve your long-term growth prospects. But I think you can be quite strong in your conclusions, and let me try to be strong in the conclusion. I say, I mean, Germany will face a more than 1% decline of working age population in the long run, 1 to 1.5 on top. If they want to see growth and they don't increase further the employment rate, which is already quite high, which means that they have to catch up by productivity. First of all, the 1.5% of employment decline, which would correspond, plus then. Must have further productivity increases in order to begin growing. I think it's quite an endeavor, and I think our conclusion, and yours, if I understand you right, is nicely pointed out, that Europe will be dead without productivity shifts. And Europe needs urgently massive productivity increases. In the case of Germany needs to, in these mechanical assumptions that I just described, needs to more than threefold to fourfold its productivity shifts, productivity gains compared to what we had before the crisis, excluding the crisis. So I think it's quite strong, and it calls really for heavy investment in human capital and heavy investment in education, unless we want companies to generate the productivity gains in a different way, namely by rationalization and laying off and changing the lacking people, substituting the lacking people by just machinery. And this is not the way in which I want to see people, our economies grow, because it would imply that the share of the cake going to workers will become smaller and smaller, and the share of the cake going to capital owners become higher and higher. I mean, I want to see our economies grow by higher education, better education, and better skills, and better skills matches.
Do we have any other questions from the floor just before we close? Nope. Then can I just add a small one for Kostas, which is talking about SMEs and future strategy. In your experience in DG Employment, bearing in mind several of your former colleagues in the audience, how far has immigration and mobility been brought into that kind of thinking about smaller businesses rather than multinationals and helping them strategize and prepare for the future? And maybe we can just go across the panel this way and then finish.
Okay. First of all, I would like to contribute also to this question of GDP per head, because I think that we forget, at least in Europe, that most countries have a very big debt. So if the population declines, the debt per capita is increasing also. So this is particularly relevant also for the UK. So we have to really to think about that. It's not so easy to say that per capita income will increase. So now for the small and medium enterprise, it's as always, you know, the job creator, major job creator in the member states is the small and medium enterprise, and you cannot leave them. They have already a very high mortality rate. Very often their mortality rate is associated with the life of the chef. And I recognize that we do not so much to inform them. If we see that even policymakers ignore the challenges of demographic aging, you can imagine what happens in a local at a local level. And of course, for years now, we are trying to help them. But I think that the most appropriate level to help them is the chambers of commerce and their chambers. And I think if there is a need for Europe to intervene, it's at this level, to make local agents which could really help the small and medium enterprise to handle these challenges.
On the question of the labour market testing, so most companies would err towards intercompany transfers, which don't. I don't know of any legislation anywhere that requires a labour market testing. But there are some countries that do enforce it. They hate it. The companies hate it. They comply with it. I was just trying to reflect on whether I'd actually ever seen a company actually fine somebody from that test. And some of them, I mean, they really do try because they prefer to employ locally. But certainly the newspapers were the winners. The internet has changed that, a lot of internet marketing. But then I was thinking about behaviours because we're an SME, I think our firm is, and as we grow into Africa and there are some active discrimination, black rights. So when we employ, we have to employ people. And somebody, an economist, asked me recently, does it work? And I said, well, I'll say, because I am totally focused on employing black women. That's all I think about all my life, you know, where we're going to get our next generation of people. And I can assure you they're going to be, because we actually can't even win work from clients unless we have a percentage and we have a ranking with this BEE rating. So I don't particularly like it because I'm a really free market person, but boy, it's I see it. You know, I can see why it's working. And that's an extreme example of implementing a strategy that is clearly working in the future.
All right. So thanks a lot for the engagement and the feedback on the presentation. So Martin, coming to your question on the GDP versus GDP per head. So I mean, what Costa said is, I think, very valid as well. So why did we take GDP? Essentially, we said, you know, when we look at companies, we take revenue, overall revenue. So that's why we figured, okay, we take overall GDP. And I mean, there is, and this is probably a longer discussion, but in business, it is a stated fact that a company has to grow to survive. If a company does not grow, it will not survive. That's what all business theory has proven forever, I guess. Yeah? So essentially, I mean, obviously, it's a you're questioning, do we need to grow forever? Yeah, that's the main question, which I think is probably then a philosophical one. I mean, this is the point we take where we say, okay, I mean, basically all the businesses have succeeded that have grown, and if businesses have not grown, they have not succeeded. So that's, you know, what we took in terms of the overall GDP. Yeah, but also coming what Costa said with the debt, it's definitely also a point. Coming to the to your question, to the second question, which is a bit what to do with these results, actually. I mean, you know, there are all these factors and you can play around, but what to do with the results because the challenge is looming. To be quite honest, and this is probably pretty pessimistic, but I mean, the question is, these results are pretty striking, and let me just make a short side story to the debt crisis. I mean, we as BCG have looked at the debt crisis, and obviously there are different perspectives. But one of our senior partners had the perspective, which is it's too much to go into detail now. But there are only basically two solutions. The one is basically hyperinflation, and the other is basically taking a proportion of the fortune of people, similar to what was done, I think, when was it, half a year ago, saying, okay, everybody has like a mandatory tax of 10% of what you own, and yes, we will also apply it to real estate. So there are basically only these two scenarios. There's a nice book on it about the market, and this is, you know, it's pretty understandable, and this is going to hit someday, but is anybody doing something about it? I don't know. So it's similar to this debate. I mean, yes, we will run into these challenges. Yes, there are different factors of what we can do. Obviously, as you mentioned, it's a terrible scenario of saying, okay, you know, we're going to be a cold, heartless country where we sort out the bad people and, you know, put productivity over everything. And, I mean, personally, if you look at the history of Europe, I think it would be a shame. But I don't, I mean, and we're definitely not the experts of the field in, you know, finding the solutions on an economic, on a European, on a country level. We don't see any you know, very powerful solutions at the moment. And that's all I can say with, you know, our perspective as being an advisor and putting basically the facts on the table.
Marco, would you have any final words? And then we shall wrap up.
Not really final words. I mean, just a few comments on what I've heard. First of all, I would like to say that, anyway, for us, all these analyses, especially the macroeconomic analysis or macro phenomena, are very useful because for us, it helps to understand in what direction we are going. In terms of management of migration flows, I think that we should also always consider that the decision to migrate is a personal, individual decisions. You cannot move 1 million people from Spain to Germany because we need to rebalance the macroeconomic effects. And if people decide to move for many of the reasons that you said, but they move if they see, especially in the intra-EU dimension, if they see an opportunity in changing country. And the opportunity comes from the fact that you can choose a project that is interesting for you. And for this is interesting, all these experiences making in, for instance, in Germany. We have heard in these conferences in Brussels many cases of employer association, especially for small and medium enterprises, to cooperating with those employment services to help people to arrive in Germany, to learn the language, and to find a final proper employment. So, migration, if it's an opportunity, people will respond well, otherwise not. Considering the best workers, as you said, maybe people, companies want the best workers. There are a number of companies that look at migration phenomenon as a way to select or recruit the best people. The majority of companies in Europe, unfortunately, they try to select migrants to have cheap labor, not cheap workforce and not the best workforce. So on one hand, we have to create instruments for companies that want to have the best people, which is, I mean, for us, having successful companies is really a good thing. But on the other side, we have to balance the legislation in order to avoid abuses, frauds, and things like this. And I think the balance is positive. And then I really hope that the European economy can be so performing in the next future that we can give employment to our citizens and also to some more migrants. We'll see. It's difficult to predict.
Marco, thank you. I think a touch of humanity at the end about people's intentions to move amongst all the data. I am going to hand the final word over to Laurent, who brings news of an event that will happen in a couple of weeks. Is that right?
Thanks very much, Liz. No, it was just because we discussed very quickly, but with interest, about regularization, potential impact on labor market outcome of migrants. It was just to mention, if it's in interest for you, that in 2 weeks' time, on the 2nd December, there will be a short seminar hosted by the International Center for Migration Policy Development, so based in Vienna, but in their Brussels office there. They will present a feasibility study they've done, so it will be perhaps more technical, not with so many results until now, but for those who may be interested more for the from the scientific perspective and how to measure to what extent regularization program can lead to better labor market outcome compared to non-regularized migrants in a way. So if you're interested, tell me and I will give you the necessary information to attend. It's in 2 weeks on 2nd December. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I'd first of all like to thank our partners, Bertelsmann Stiftung, for being such a fabulous, as always, partner for these events. I'd like to thank Maria Vincenza for putting this event together. Those of you who don't know her, Maria Vincenza Desiderio is our newest policy analyst at NPR Europe. It's when you're a small think tank, you get to have exponential growth with every single addition. So welcome, Maria Vincenza. I'd like to thank all of our panelists for joining us today. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I think hopefully the first of us, more discussions we have here at NPR Europe. We spend an enormous time focusing on particularly labour migration, but also migrant integration across Europe, as well as EU and national policy development. So hopefully we can welcome you back on another occasion. And my final word is, please buy Martin's book. It's very good.
4 more on MPI Europe, its events, and its research, please visit mpieurope.org.